great. Hey, it's been a full week for me. I know it's been a full week for you. For those who are listening, though, why don't you tell everybody, give everybody a little intro or what happened in our family with our mom over the weekend?
Oh my goodness, our precious dear mom was out messing with their little pool, and she tripped on a cord, fell, hit her head on the deck, ended up with 2 black eyes and 30 stitches.
I thought it was 40. Grandpa or Dad said it was 40 stitches.
Yeah, probably. So. Probably close to that with the internal and external.
Yeah, she does not look good. I mean, not the scar or not the cut itself, because the cut, you know, it's a cut. It's going to leave a scar. But you can tell it was like being in a car accident for her. She's, and in fact, Dad was saying today she's been most of the time in bed just because she feels like her whole body is sick and has gone through a car accident. So, but yeah, it was quite the, I mean, I talked to Dad right away that morning when he was in the emergency room. And then when they sent the picture, I was like, oh my, oh, that's a legit fall to the head. I mean,
yeah,
it's a doozy. It's, you know, whoo, all the way up. And so I did send her a picture of Herman Munster, though, the next day when she was feeling better. So
you're so thoughtful.
I'm terrible. But thoughtful. Yeah, yeah. Hey, let's jump into it. We got a lot to cover today. I wanted to just real quick bring up an interesting article I ran across just this last week. The movie Oppenheimer is coming out about the atomic bomb. In fact, Dad was going to go see it that day that Mom fell with your son. And in that, I saw this article regarding Matt Damon and how he works exclusively with the director of this movie in all of his movies. And so his wife, who he's been married to for 20 years, they were in marriage counseling, and the marriage counselor and he and his wife decided that they were taking time off, but then they negotiated if he was offered this part in Oppenheimer that he would be able to go back to work. And it was interesting to me because they've been married 20 years. They've talked pretty openly about, you know, his career. And she was I think just a waitress. She was like she was a bartender, I think. So it wasn't like he married some other, you know, actress. So they've been able to keep things pretty, you know, normalized in a sense. And Matt Damon talks about his mom as his hero and she's a school teacher. So he sounds pretty down to earth. But in that, I kept thinking two things leading into our first point, but have you ever, in your counseling, have you ever had a couple come in with a chosen topic to help you negotiate them on, you know, how they're going to work through this? Not necessarily a problem, but just like a negotiator. Hey, he wants to buy a new car, I don't. Or, you know, he wants to travel to Florida, I don't. Or whatever it is. Have you ever faced that?
Yes, I had a couple come in and they wanted me to help them talk through whether they should move out of state. He wanted to move and she didn't. And so there was all kinds of things to discuss and pros and cons. And they knew that they would just argue. So they wanted a third party to help them talk through it.
That is so wise. I'm still amazed at people who are wise enough to do that and know this is going to go nowhere. So rather than burn hours and weeks and months, let's go sit down with someone. So how did you help them? What was the outcome?
Well, for me, of course, this is such a therapist answer, but we started off with the pros and cons, but then my goal was for them to understand the emotions underneath why he wanted to go and she wanted to stay. And so there were things like deep down, she was really afraid that she would lose connection with her mom. And she was afraid her children would not have she did not have a good relationship with her grandma, and she wanted her kids to have a different and a good relationship. And so she didn't want to move out of state because she thought that would, you know, so we had to get to the feelings. And then his underlying feelings of wanting to move because he felt inadequate here and he thought he could make more of himself out there. So we got to the feelings so that they would understand where each other's coming from.
Ah, good. Yeah, I like that. You know, if you just simply make a list of pros and cons, you can still make the wrong decision for what's best for you as a couple. So I like that. So with that, you know what? I'm going to go just the opposite direction. It's going to sound like I'm not making much sense, but Matt Damon is definitely the unicorn in when it comes to movie stars. Most movie stars, their relationships don't last. They're not healthy. But what are the careers that you think do better or are more successful or that need healthy relationships in order to be better or successful? Now, I'll give you the opposite example that I just gave you. A movie star, we see them burn through relationships left and right, and it never really affects their career. You know, people adore them and many times don't even know who they're married to. So they can get married and divorced 6, 7, 8 times and still be a big box office smash hit, where in reality, other people in the roles that they play in their occupations, it might not work that way. Now, this is just a list I came up with off the top of my head, and I'd love your opinion. I think, and it's a short list, here are careers that I think need healthy relationships in order to be effective and successful. One would be farmers. If you've ever worked on a farm, you know it's 24/7. Pastors or anyone in ministry.
Yep.
Therapists or counselors. And I think part of it with therapists and counselors is I'm not going to go to a therapist or a counselor who doesn't have a healthy marriage. It wouldn't make sense to me. And then the last thought I had was anyone who has a traveling career or an offshore career, or they have to be gone for a great distance. There was a gentleman in my church back in Seattle. His name was Ed. Great guy. And he was a crabber. And he'd work half the year on, half the year off. And he said something interesting. He said, men on that boat, they either have amazing relationships or they have no relationships. He said they've either learned how to navigate the 6 months away and then the 6 months back, or they haven't. He said there's no middle ground. He said there's no one that he worked with, and this was a lifetime career. And by the way, he said he was bad because he still had all 10 fingers. But he said there was nobody in his lifetime career that stayed in a poor marriage, because the smallest slight or the smallest little idiosyncrasy or weakness then gets completely blown out of proportion when you're gone 6 months or when you come back for 6 months. So what are your thoughts?
I totally agree with your list, and I would add, and this I'm not totally certain, but I wonder if we would add on there people that work jobs that have like a fireman, they're on for several days and then they're off for several days. And one of the reasons I think those kind of first responder careers need a healthy marriage to help their job is because if you have small children, the stress of childcare as a single parent is enormous. And so I think it's really hard to stay in those type of schedules when you're responsible for your kids without a healthy marriage and healthy co-parent.
Good point. You know, that also makes me then think, if you are I don't want to make it sound like not every doctor is important, but if you're an elite surgeon or you're an elite doctor, that would imagine the stress would be greater. And again, to be able to come home and to function effectively. Again, what I'm saying is that you have to have healthy relationships in order to be successful in that career. I know many doctors that are successful doctors like actors, and their marriages are trashed. But I would imagine there would be some significant rollover. If you have a healthy relationship, it does make it easier to be a successful or well-functioning fireman, policeman, or doctor, anything like that. So,
Yep, I agree.
Cool. Do you think there's anyone listening right now who goes, that must be why my career isn't successful, it's because my marriage isn't successful, or might have a thought like that, what would be advice you might give them?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with stress levels. So if you don't have a healthy marriage, it's an enormous amount of stress, this undercurrent of stress and difficulty that you're carrying. And then it's hard to function at your peak level in any other area when there's an ongoing level of stress and disagreement and dissension, conflict, or just unhappiness. I think it starts to erode you as a person. So my advice is get help right away. Obviously, I would say that. But I think that I would really ask people who are not married, who are considering marrying, to think even about their choice of mate and how does that line up with their choice of career, because it's going to impact it. So if you have a chance to think about that before you commit to marriage, do it. If you're already married, I think that the best thing you can do is to constantly work towards open dialogue with your spouse, because it's going to be very hard to not damage yourself or the other person if the marriage isn't good and yet you're also trying to excel in your career.
Right. I also think many times a spouse, even if they have a job, if they're married to someone in one of these other, you know, occupations that we said, doctor, fireman, policeman, whatever, ministry, they might not understand the amount of stress that that person's under. They might assume, you know, people, they give you accolades and praise and, you know, you're a hero. You know, what stress is there? And those are all nice. And, you know, from being in a large church, as do I, that all that praise does not take away from the stress or the day-to-day grind that you're under. And so sometimes a spouse doesn't see that. The other thing that I think about is in Genesis 3, when God comes down, Adam and Eve have sinned, he hands out the curses. And one of the curses for Adam is the word Zeah. And it basically means you will labor over the ground thinking that it will fulfill you, but it never will. So it's like, you know, you bring in the crop and what a great year, but there's always more work to do. There's always more work to do. And so how it translates in today's world is a guy gets a job and then he gets a promotion and then he gets another promotion and then he can get a bigger car and a bigger house. And when the wife and the marriage isn't fulfilling, it's easier for him to pour himself even more into his work.
Right.
And in a sense, the poor relationship almost adds to the success of the business because the guy doesn't want to be home and he wants to pour more time into the office and the job and things like that. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, but it's definitely worth thinking about talking. And I love the fact that you said before you get married, you know, talk about the stress. Patrick Bet David, and this is my last rabbit trail. He shares a story. He's a high-driven entrepreneur. He knows his personality. He knows he's driven. And he and his wife, at the time, were dating. They were thinking of getting married. So we said, we should go to a marriage counselor and talk to them about, you know, would we be compatible? So the very first visit, he first interviewed the marriage counselor. And he said it was, I think, $100 an hour. And he asked the marriage counselor what he did. He said, well, you know, I'm a part-time pastor, part-time counselor. And he said, well, how many hours do you put in a week? And it was a typical 40-hour week. And he said, well, thank you, sir. I really appreciate it. You're not going to be able to help us. Paid him the $100 and left. And his wife was all upset, like, what are you doing? He said, he can't help us. He doesn't understand my lifestyle, my personality. We need to go to someone who is the same cut of the same cloth, the same makeup, the same personality, so that I can hear an objective perspective. And again, when you talk to couples, they need to understand that who you talk to about stress and expectations varies greatly on whether or not you'll receive the help you need. Because if you come to me, I'm probably going to think you're not busy at all. You're not doing anything because I'm 24/7. Let's go now. If you sit down with the next person, they might feel like, oh, this is completely manageable because they don't understand the personalities that they're working with. So it's just, you know, talk about that stress and have someone who understands the stress level of each person in order for it to be effective.
It's good.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sitting here drinking nasty old coffee, and I'm eating Charleston shoes, just in case the listeners are wondering. So let's get into the big topic for today is what to do when your partner is condescending. And I think anyone who's been married can relate to some degree. There have been moments in marriage where things have been said or actions have been taken that make you feel belittled or patronized or something like that. But there's a social psychologist, Sarah Nazareda. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And she said she did a study on the effects of a condescending attitude in relationships. She said that it's basically a little chip, you know, you just chip away at the relationship. And at first, in most relationships, it can come across as humor or sarcasm, but over time, it completely destroys the relationship. And so she said she thinks being condescending is rampant, more common than we think. And as you continue to do research, one of the things that people point out is in today's world, with ever since TV started and the media, you would watch a show like, say, Family Ties. And it's funny and you laugh at it, but if you ever treated anyone in your family with the same type of sarcasm or condescension or condescending or condescension, I hate it when it drips, you know, it won't last. You can't get away with that in real life. So she talks about how this builds up then, and we then do begin to do that in our own relationships, and things fall apart. Anyway, she said, here are four main things that condescending relationships or a condescending partner can do. Number one, it can absolutely wreak havoc on a patient's mental health. So from your experience, when people come in for counseling and you see things like this chipping away at someone's mental health, explain to me the steps you try to understand or take with them, whether the other person's in the room or not. How do you handle that?
Well, the thing that comes to mind is if I have a spouse that's condescending to me on a regular basis, then I begin to lose the ability to trust myself, because when someone is condescending, it makes me question, did I do this wrong, or was there something wrong with this, or are you disapproving of me? And if you get that enough of it, you start believing there must be something wrong with me. It erodes your sense of confidence or self-esteem, and it builds up this resentment. And it also, when someone is being condescending, I think very easily for that person who's being condescending, that can drift into then being contemptuous and just being, you know, nasty. So when they come into therapy and someone has been condescended to constantly, I first build a relationship, but eventually try to get to a point where I can gently ask the condescender, hey, how come you are relating to your spouse like a parent, like you're condescending, you're talking to them like a child, or are you aware that you're doing that? Where is that coming from? Why do you suppose you do that? And then building confidence in the spouse to be able to really say how that makes them feel, and to really discover what has the impact been on them if there's been regular condescending towards them from their spouse. That's my first thought.
I'm sure that people would, even as you bring that up, probably have a rebuttal or even say, no, I'm not. I mean, how do you handle the person who really is like, they don't see it and they don't get it? Is there ever a breakthrough?
Yeah, because you gently have their spouse give examples, and then I can confirm that there is validity that their spouse feels condescended to, without pointing my finger and lobbing a huge blame. Is just helping the spouse become aware of how their words are coming across to their spouse and how that makes them feel. And then the bigger goal is, you know, is this how you want your spouse to feel? Do you want to be in a marriage where whether you intend, and that's the thing too, we talk about intention, and I try to help them understand it doesn't matter if you didn't intend to be condescending. If that's the message your spouse got, then that's the message, whether we intended it right or not. So trying to help them understand, it's not whether you intended to, it's not if you meant just to be joking. If your spouse feels put down by that, then that is going to just have a domino effect, and it's not going to produce the kind of marriage that most people want to be in.
Right. I know a lot of counselors use a video that they videotape the couple interacting and then wait a few weeks and show it back to them. Do you do that, or would you even recommend a couple doing that when they're at home having a discussion, saying, hey, why don't you pull out your phone, sit down at the table, and videotape you two discussing this? I'm sure at first there's a little bit of posturing, but you know, at some point the gloves come off and you just become who you are. But would that be effective?
Yes. I often have asked couples when they're at an impasse and somebody is not really seeing how they're coming across, I will say, okay, your homework is you have to videotape yourselves talking for at least 20 minutes. And then they look at it, or we look at it together. And you're right. Sometimes it takes a while to really, for them to kind of forget that they're being videoed. But there's even the beginning of an education of looking at those slight tone of voice, the words they're choosing, what their face looks like, what their body language is doing. I think that's a very effective tool for helping them recognize, you know, behavior that is not helpful.
Right. I think, and again, I don't have the vast experience you have, but one of the things that I've noticed in relationships like that when they come in is the person who's on the receiving end of the condescension, over time, literally out of having to survive, they adapt almost a completely different personality, and they become someone completely different. At least when they come home or when they're around their spouse. Is that a long-term effect, something? Will they ever overcome that? Do they have to divorce or leave the person? How do they overcome that?
Well, there's a variety of ways. Sometimes they come and get help, or they start working on things and they find their voice again, and they are able to really speak up and communicate how that kind of behavior makes them feel, and that they begin to get stronger, and without hatefulness, they begin to draw some boundaries and be able to say, hey, I'm not going to receive you talking to me that way anymore. And if you want to talk about this without putting me down or talking condescending or treating me like a child, you know, we can do that. But right now I feel like, you know, so sometimes they get healthy and they draw some boundaries. Sometimes it so erodes and disintegrates that spouse. They just keep shutting down, shutting down, shutting down, shutting down. And then they just kind of become roommates or yes people, like, okay, whatever. And then, but then they're the ones that there has to be an outlet for their real selves. And then they're vulnerable to making bad choices, getting involved with someone else, or, you know, drug and alcohol, just to feel like they can take off the lid from those, you know, because they keep themselves so tamped right down. It can go a variety of ways. And then some just say, I can't be in this marriage because I can't be myself, because they are overbearing and condescending.
Right. You know, I think there's also the idea that if you're in that relationship, a dumb example, but the price is right. You know, they're standing on the stage and the person has to guess the price, and the whole crowd is yelling different prices, you know, some higher, some lower. And the person just sits there, almost freezes, and they lose the ability on how to make choices in their own life.
Yes.
In a lot of relationships, I see that happens when you're with someone who picks on every choice and decision you make without even realizing it. You so second guess yourself, and maybe it's a self-esteem issue, but then you lose the ability to make healthy choices. You become dependent.
You do.
And, you know, I don't know the easiest or best way to help someone out of that, but I've seen people grow up that way and or come out of relationships like that. And it's a long road to recovery with that mindset for most people. So have you ever had a history with anybody working in that direction with them?
Oh, totally. And then it's helping them to relearn how to have a voice and how to trust their voice, how to trust their gut feeling, how to trust their decision-making process. And it starts out slow. It starts with little decisions that go well. And then you remind them of the successes that they've had and that they do, they can possess what they need to make those choices and decisions.
Do you think when you look at dating / marriage relationships that whether it's consciously or not, condescenders choose to date people who are easily manipulated or pushovers?
That's a good question. Well, I'll come at it at a different way. I think it's very likely that people who communicate with condescension are often deeply insecure and don't feel good about themselves. And so it's that classic, I'm going to put someone else down to try to cover up my own feelings of inadequacy. And so I think then that type of person, if they're insecure, they might gravitate to someone that they feel like they can have the upper hand with to try to shore up their own feelings about themselves.
That's a possibility, but I'm not disagreeing with you. But what about this scenario? If you are more indecisive or passive, someone who's condescending can come across as someone who's strong-willed and driven and a leader, and you might gravitate towards that person, and then you don't realize that all those qualities that were positive also have a negative side. And it becomes very condescending. And then what you were looking for in that relationship, you don't realize he's not just a leader, he's a controller, you know, things like that. So I think that's more what I've seen. So,
yeah, I think that's true, Garth.
You're the professional.
I think you're onto something. And I think probably it comes from both ends of that continuum. Because I do see that same thing a lot where a person gets married, they like their spouse, husband or wife, they were strong, they were opinionated, they were decisive. That felt good, maybe because the other person didn't like to make decisions, didn't feel too confident. So I think you're onto something with that.
Okay. Well, here's some cues that you might be with someone who's condescending. I would assume most people would know, but maybe not. Cues as what they say and how they say it. So it's not just that they cut you down, but many times in the tone of voice. And I'll use an example. When I talk about the four horsemen in marriage counseling, this was probably 15 years ago, a husband and wife were in my office. And the example was, well, you know, all I did was ask what was for dinner. And the woman said, that's what you said, but that's not what you meant. And he said, well, what did I mean? And she said, what you meant was, I can't believe you blankety blank didn't fix anything, you lazy blankety blank. And I was like, oh, wow. And the guy said, well, yeah, kind of, but I didn't say that. But it was just, you know, so it wasn't just what they said, but it's that whole vibe, yeah, or, you know, that feeling that you get. In our family, we used to joke, because when the boys were real young, and I've probably shared this before, our example was any word can be a bad word if it's with the wrong attitude. And so my example was, you could use the word watermelon and it could be a bad word. You know, you could say, you watermelon. Well, that became a family joke then. You know, everyone would say something. What happened? Oh, he was just being such a watermelon, you know? And so, but again, it wasn't the word itself. It was the intention. So what they say, how they say, how do you get someone to hear how they sound? How do you get someone to hear that they're condescending?
Yeah, that's like the couple I had in my office years ago. And she was trying to explain why she was upset, why she felt like they needed help, what the problem was. And yes, she had a lot of words, and he simply interrupted her and he said, could you get to the point? And it was so condescending. And all he said was, could you get to the point? But what he really said was, you're such an idiot. You don't know how to explain yourself. And I'm embarrassed. And the message was loud and clear. He was so condescending. So I think it's hard to get someone to know and realize how they sound. It's really, really hard.
Could you get to the point? Could you get to the point, please?
It's really about the person's attitude. Are they willing to see themselves through their spouse's eyes? And if they can't do that, then you have a lot of work to do to try to get them to be able to take that perspective, because they may never agree with it or see it themselves. But if I talk that way and my husband said, you know, that really is offensive to me, it hurts my feelings, I can't believe you talk that way, and I have to value my relationship enough to say, I am so sorry. I had no idea. To me, it just sounds like I'm trying to be funny. So, yeah, it can be tough.
So, yeah, the next one is kind of the same. It's how they treat you, but then how they also treat you around others. Yeah. And what's surprising to me is, I've noticed in some relationships, I can be condescending at home, but not out in front of other people with my spouse. But as time goes by and as years go on, pretty soon I don't care. And I can act just as condescending in public around people with my spouse as I can at home. And of course, I don't, but I'm using me as an example for hyperbole. But what are the things is there a scale in your head that you try to teach people, like, well, if he treats you like this at home and or he treats you like this out in public, be aware or run away or, you know, go to counseling. I don't know.
I usually use the kind of verbiage that says something like, if it stings something even just a little bit, if it pings anything inside you in the beginning, you need to listen to that.
What's the danger if you don't listen to that?
That typically those kinds of things just grow when we're married. And if you don't listen to that, then you in essence, you're training them or conditioning them of how you're willing to be treated. And so it's important right away to speak up and say, hey, could you say that a little nicer? Or, hey, I'm not sure I'm okay with the way you talk to me, or, hey, that was hurtful. And then if it continues and they're not willing to make efforts to change, then get out, you know, then you're in trouble. Don't marry the person for sure. And if you're already married, then you better get in and get some help.
Right. So I also hear you saying do your due diligence in who you're dating. Before you get married, maybe do some homework. How do they treat their mom, their dad, their brothers, sisters, the people they work with, their neighbor, the people at church, whatever? Because they're gonna double down on that, and that's how they're gonna treat you.
Yep, that's true. And you know, sometimes, so in our marriage, Mitch has very sarcastic humor, which we talked about at our last recording. But there are times when I've just had to say, that does not feel good to me. And I ask him to stop or to say it a different way. It's my responsibility to speak up, and it's his responsibility to receive that and apologize when it's need be. Because we are training each other how to treat one another.
Right. Yeah. Good point. Have you ever heard the illustration of the oasis?
No.
About
no.
You're dying of thirst. You're out in the desert, and up ahead you see this oasis, and you can't believe it. It's this fresh spring water with some palm trees, and you see a bunch of people there, but all you see is fresh water, and you rush and you're knocking people over and you're jumping over people and you're going around these animals and everybody that's there for this fresh water, and you start drinking it till you're completely full. And then by the time you stop, you look around and you see everybody here is dead. They all drank from this water and they died. But your thirst for water blinded you of the consequences. And the point would be your thirst for a relationship blinded you to the poison in this person. And yeah. You were so blown away that they loved you and showed you some attention, and they said you were pretty, and you're 38, the clock is ticking, or whatever it is, you become blinded, and then you're in the relationship, or even worse yet, you're married, and now you're stuck in this toxic relationship, and you realize this wasn't an oasis at all, it's actually poison, and now it's a little too late. So again, do your due diligence. Yeah. I tell my boys, definitely check up on the ex-boyfriends that those girls dated and talk to them, you know. Find out everything you can, because this is going to be the mother of your kids. It's going to be my daughter-in-law. It's going to be the person you go to bed with. So do your due diligence. So you kind of covered this, but the last cue would be, how do they make you feel, and do they care how they make you feel?
Yeah, that's good. Absolutely. How do they make you feel? And push through the oxytocin, the bonding hormone that starts coursing through our veins, because love is blind and we feel that rush of, and we can be blinded. So really have to take enough time to say, how do they make me feel? Am I paying attention to those cues? And do they care if they make me feel, if they're hurtful, and if they make me feel offended? Do they listen to that? Are they willing to talk that through with me? Because that's important.
Right. Yeah, there was a breakthrough in our relationship with Kim and I when at some point she quit telling me, don't say that, I don't like when you say that, to where she would start to say, it makes me feel like this. And that yes. really hit me, because I'm like, I don't ever want to make you feel like that. And when she would say, don't say that, I don't like the way you say that, I could say, oh, I'm just joking, which usually I was, or maybe I used the sarcasm to make a point. But it was easier for me to, you know, pass it off. And then when she started to say, it makes me feel like this, that really struck me, because I'm like, I don't ever want to make anybody feel like that, especially my spouse. So, you know, how they make you feel and whether they care or not is a big one. So what to do? We were talking about this in our notes. There are basically four things, one kind of backs on the other, of what to do. But you said the first one, which is to confess to your partner how you feel,
yeah,
you know, and how their actions, how it makes them feel. The next one, and these are in no order, is to seek counseling. And again, I think you have to be careful who you seek counseling from. But with that being said, my thought is that sometimes you're in the heat of battle and you tell the spouse who's the one condescending, you know, I think we need counseling. And it's almost like fuel for the fire. Like, oh, we need counseling because I made fun of you. Oh, my goodness. I can't believe I'm not going to go into a counselor and, you know, say we have to talk about this because it's not a big deal. You know, so how do you get your spouse in that situation to actually try to think about pursuing counseling?
I love the phrase, hey, this, how we're doing this, this isn't working for me. And I don't know, I'm speaking for myself, I don't know how to do it different. And I want us to go and talk to somebody that can help us learn how to do this different. Because this dynamic, it's not working for me, and I don't know how to change it. So speaking for yourself, right. And they say, fine, go, I don't need help. Then you go by yourself, you know,
yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think I covered this in one of our podcasts. If not, I did on the David Alliance, my other podcast. The explanation to your partner that, you know, there are three types of relationships, healthy, unhealthy, and no relationship. And you just kindly explain to your spouse, I want to have a healthy relationship. I refuse to have an unhealthy relationship. So if you're not committed to having a healthy relationship and I feel it's unhealthy, then in that particular area, we're going to have no relationship. And that doesn't mean you pack up and move out. It just means if you're going to act unhealthy when I talk about vacation or finances or your job or your personal habit, then I'm not going to have that conversation, because unless we can do it in a healthy manner, then we'll have no relationship. So it's a healthy relationship or no relationship. You get to choose by how you respond. That helps. A lot of times with men, sometimes it can take a while for them to start to really feel that and then say, okay, you know, I want to work on this. I want to get better. So the last three ideas here is they say to take note of whether you feel like that person has listened and changed. And again, I guess the fear would be that they're changing just for the moment to kind of shut you up. What in your mind would be long enough or consistent enough change to where the person could feel like they can, you know, trust them and let down and step back into that healthy relationship?
I get that question a lot about, you know, how long does it take or how long should I? And I always tell people, you have to take time frames off the table, because every situation is different. And every person's tolerance level. So what I might think is huge change in my spouse, someone else might look, my brother might look at that and go, he hasn't changed at all. So that really has to, boy, that's really dependent on what the person has to judge for themselves. I can't really give, I mean, certainly longer than a few months, but that's a really unanswerable question, because everyone's different.
Right, right. Yeah, there's a few examples I won't share just because it takes too much time, but people have jumped too soon. So he changed or they changed, and no, they didn't, so be careful. The last two is to stay soft and pray, meaning don't let their condescending attitude make you hard or you become condescending, and really take time to pray over the relationship and ask God to help lead you in this, as well as a good counselor.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Again, the danger is you can go into survival mode and become a different person. And then you almost become impossible to live with anyway, because you become a grouch because you lived with a grouch or something like that. So if there's someone listening who goes, my goodness, that's kind of where I'm at. I don't enjoy my life anymore because I don't enjoy my spouse. How might they start to disassemble from that personality or relationship?
Talk to a third party. Talk to a good friend and ask a good friend for just some feedback. A friend, hopefully, that knows both you and your spouse and will give you some honest feedback. Ask people that know and love you to privately tell you, do they think you're seeing this clearly? Tell them how you feel. So get some feedback from people that really know you. Obviously people that you feel are wise and can be objective, and then use that, to inform your next step, because sometimes it's a drastic step and you have to separate for a while, or sometimes it's a subtle step and you just have to get up the courage to actually talk to your husband or wife about how they're making them feel and how are making you feel and how you want them to change. So I say, get some feedback from an outside source.
Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. And I would add, in today's society, I can't overemphasize enough how healthy it is to be around four or five couples at a time, go do something, hang out. And then after the fact, ask those couples, you know, by yourself, am I overreacting the way my husband treats me or talks to me? Am I overreacting by what my wife says? And get fresh perspectives. It's healthy to be with other couples to begin with. Even when they're unhealthy, it can actually sometimes help you more. But when you're around healthy couples and you can reflect off of them after the party or after the get-together, and you do it numerous times to where you can get they can get a good feel, I think that's incredibly healthy and gives you a great sounding board. So, and then finally, this last point is, if you are, whether you're married or not, choose a time to leave in order to assess where you're at. So again, I'm not advocating divorce, but you might have to separate and say, I can't live with this person anymore, or and tell your spouse, I can't live with you anymore. Or if you're not married, assess, at what point do I walk away from this relationship? And, you know, am I in love with the convenience, or am I in love with the person? Because after a while, condescending attitudes wreck both. So rather you get out sooner than later.
Yep. There is a very, if people will Google therapeutic separation, they can see some of the values in separating and really getting some clarity and really having a little bit of space. So you realize, you become aware of, oh, how I have been treated, or how I've been treating somebody. It can bring a lot of clarity, which is really helpful.
Good, good, good. Excellent. Wow, we're hitting almost, 45 minutes. So today was a good one. Hey, so first of all, I love you. I'm so happy you're my sister.
Thank you.
I am publicly thankful for my father taking care of my mom right now while she's going through this. We have a great dad, great example. So our parting last words regarding either this topic or where you're at, what would you like to tell the audience?
I'd like to tell the audience that the Bible talks about how a fitting word is like soothing to the soul, and it talks about how our tongues can be like a sword. And so I just want to encourage the audience, be that fitting word, don't be the sword.
Good point. Yeah, I would go ahead and I'm going to double down on this. Wherever you're at in your relationship, get together with other healthy couples, hang out with them, and allow that to be some of the medicine and some of the correction and wisdom that you need in becoming better with your spouse. So go ahead and do it. Hey, everyone, this is Garth Heckman, MingleMateMarried.com. After today, I was joking. If you work on your relationship, you might want to buy one of those hoodies that say it's a great day to be married.
Yeah.
I know people who are getting engaged like buying those. And if it doesn't work out, you can buy the one that says it's a good day for a divorce. And I'm just kidding. Oh. It's not on there. But make sure you check it out. Also, all of our social media, make sure you let us know how you think we're doing. We want to help you. We can only help you better when you give us your feedback. So thank you very much. Sheree Milton, I love you. Have a great day. I'm sure we will talk very soon.
Love you too, brother. Have a good afternoon.
All right. Bye.
Bye.